You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Justin Montoku ingoa. E whakarongo ana koe ki te Wire marunga irirangi pōho mō tēnei rā, te rā tekau mā tahi o whiringa anuku. Kia ora, you're listening to 95 BFM, and this is the Thursday Wire for October 21st. I am Justin Wong, your host. Haere ake nei, coming up on the show today, we have our usual chat with Health and Treaty Negotiations Minister Andrew Little for our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party. Schools will be reopening after Labour weekend, even under Level 3 conditions. News Hub is proposing to slash the radio news reporter's role after ending an arrangement with MediaWorks, and a bipartisan housing policy would see density rules changed to allow more medium density housing across the country. As usual, he aha o whakaro. Let me know what you think. Tukupatuhi mai, the text number is 5395, or if you want to call me, the number is 309-3879. Kaua e waere waere, e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anohi pakihere rokiroki marunga i te pai tukutuku o irirangi pōho. Me haere ki 95BFM ira kati.com. As always, you can catch all these stories and other shows on by podcast on the 95BFM website on 95bfm.com/bcast. I tēnei wā tonu. Now, let's get the show on the road.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
This week with Health Minister Andrew Little, I asked him about the government's decision to set aside 300 MIQ spots for health workers and his thoughts on National's reopening plan, which would reopen the economy on December 1st, regardless of vaccination rates. But I began by talking to Andrew Little about the vaccination rates for Māori at Taranaki and Tairawhiti. So it's been 8 months since money was made available by Cabinet to train Māori vaccinators and set up a Māori vaccination program. But 8 months on, even after Super Saturday, the rates in Taranaki and Tairawhiti are still very much lower than the national rate. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. So, some extra support and so on has gone in to those regions. But the reality is you're dealing with a lot of people who have not been connected to the health system for a very long time, if ever, and they are in that kind of classic hard to reach category. But that's why working through Māori health providers and others, we support them to do that work. Their challenge they've laid down is actually some of the support they've been getting hasn't been enough, and it is pretty clear too that things like getting the right information, getting the right data to help them support their campaigns, that has not been forthcoming. So some of that goes to relationship issues between the DHBs and those Māori health providers. There's been a lot of work in the last few weeks about trying to kind of reset that. Getting around Taranaki in the weekend and talking to some of the Māori health providers, they're saying that the relationship is now a lot better, but that is something that has happened literally in the last few weeks.
Well, is it acceptable that Māori health providers, especially in Taranaki, have to resort to crowdfunding for a mobile vaccination clinic?
Yeah, I certainly saw that in Tairawhiti. And again, the call has gone out. What is it that you need? In the end, these things come down to the relationship between those providers and the DHB. They should not have to be crowdsource funding for a bus to go and get on the road and roll out their vaccination program. The DHB should be supporting them in that. So look, there's ongoing dialogue with some of those providers to say, we need your efforts to be focused on actually getting in touch with your people, talking to them, and getting them vaccinated. You should not have to be doing that fundraising. So, we're trying to do what we can at the moment to address that.
But in general, after 8 months, should Māori vaccinations should be stripped from DHBs or the Ministry of Health and given directly to Māori health providers instead?
Well, they have in large parts of the country. That is in fact what has happened, that Māori health providers have been contracted to run the vaccination program. And I know I've been to vaccination centres run by iwi health providers. I went to one in Tamaki a couple of months ago, run by Ngāti Whaita Ōrākei and Ngāti Pāua. And, you know, so that has been happening, but there are in some parts of the country where the DHB does not seem to have buddied up with the local Māori health providers in the same way. And we're seeing the results of that. So as we know with this pandemic, it has exposed a lot about our health system and the way it works and the inequities in it. This is just another one. This is a good reason why we need the reforms.
Why is the relationship not that good?
Well, that's a good question. It's not something I can easily drill into, but when Māori health providers say to me the relationship isn't that good, they don't engage very deeply on issues, they don't get a lot of cooperation, I take them at their word, and it is for DHBs to step up and provide leadership and get on and make that relationship work. DHBs have a statutory duty to ensure that the health needs of their relevant population are being met. And one of the ways that that happens, particularly for Māori, is to be in touch with and engage with Māori health providers. It's my expectation that DHBs do that. Some are doing it better than others.
Okay. Going on to my second topic for the day, recently you announced that there will be 300 dedicated spots in MIQ for healthcare workers, but these won't be kicking in until November. Well, are you leaving this a little bit too late?
No, we've always had, we brought a lot of health workers across the border to fill gaps during, since the lockdown, or since the pandemic started last year and the borders were closed. So we have brought a lot of people through. There was meant to be a system where there were a dedicated number of places, but it just has not been working effectively. And I've been, in the time I've been health minister, called on, I think, four times to intervene with different organisations, DHBs and PHOs, to try to work out how to get particular much-needed workers across the border. And I've done that, and in doing that, I've said, well, what is the problem here? It turns out that the system hasn't been particularly streamlined, that the whatever allocation was in place before hasn't been well utilised. So I've worked with colleagues and the officials in the Ministry of Health and Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment to make sure that there's dedicated space and that there is a streamlined process for organisations to get health workers who they recruit offshore over the border and into our health system. So that is now in place. It kicks off from the 1st of November. But there's now, best part of a week for health organisations who are waiting to get people across the border to contact them. They can get the arrangements in place and we can get those places filled from November.
You said you intervened four times since you got the health portfolio to let health workers into MIQ. How many in total got sped up?
On those four occasions, it would be probably, on one occasion it was four people, another it was a couple of people, and then one each for the other. So not huge numbers, obviously, but it became it was a way for me to kind of understand practically what is and isn't happening. And actually, there was more not happening than happening. So that was the spur to working with officials and other ministers to make sure that we can kind of clear the blockages, get some streamlining, and get the thing working. I think part of the problem was that a whole heap of different organisations were all kind of applying through the old process, and they're all being treated kind of separately, not necessarily seen as sort of priority health workers. So we've changed that process. There's now the dedicated spaces, 300 spaces a month for health workers. I'm confident that that'll make a big difference in terms of getting those folks across the border.
Would you prioritise certain categories of healthcare workers?
Oh, look, there's a lot. We have massive shortages, nurses, specialists in aged residential care. They're trying to get nurses across the border too, and other healthcare workers. So there are a lot of vacancies everywhere. So we'll just do the best we can to fill those places and get people who are waiting to take up employment in New Zealand, and likewise employers in New Zealand waiting to get the healthcare workers into New Zealand. We'll just fill those places up as quickly as we can.
Would you see to grow more MIQ spots in the future? As you said, there are a lot of vacancies hanging around in the system.
Yeah, look, managing the MIQ sort of capacity is a challenging thing at the best of times, and we are adding capacity. And we know, look, there's a lot of New Zealanders who are not healthcare workers who want to come home, and we need to get them places in MIQ as quickly as we can. The way things are going with vaccination levels rising and getting to a point where we won't need to isolate as many people in MIQ facilities, more people can isolate at home or be cared for in their home, means that some capacity will be freed up eventually, but it is a constant balancing act to deal with that.
Okay, moving to my final topic for today. Well, National announced its reopening plan yesterday, saying it will reopen the economy in 6 weeks at the start of December, regardless of vaccination rates. I want to know, what are you thinking about this?
Well, we want to reduce the restrictions as quickly as possible, just like everybody else. But the reality is we still have pockets of the population who are not vaccinated and who are therefore exposed and who are therefore remain a risk to the rest of us, because while they're unvaccinated, they are more contagious. And if they do contract the virus, they're more likely to get a lot more sick and put pressure on our health system. So we have to weigh all those sorts of things up. I mean, there was a lot in that package there that frankly didn't add up. There's a lot of things they want to spend money on, they want to reduce revenue, and then claim that they're going to repay debt as well at the same time. So, look, I think we all want to get to the ideal spot where we can start reducing the restrictions, get back to kind of life as much as possible as normal. But the overwhelming sentiment I get and my colleagues get from New Zealanders is, but you've got to keep us safe. We want to be kept safe from the virus. And so we are in that constant juggling act to do that.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little. The Wire.
Ko te waia, tēnei marunga I re rangi poho. You tuned into the Thursday Wire on 95 BFM, and that was Health Minister and Treaty Negotiations Minister Andrew Little. The time has just passed a quarter after noon here in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. We will be back after a quick break, but if you have any opinions on housing, whether schools should reopen under level 3 or other any topics, just let me know. The text number is 5395, or if you want to talk to me, the number is 309-3879. We'll be back after a bit.
Fun-sized chocolate bars, baby animals, shiny dollar coins, me. Good things come in small packages. And what could be gooder than Show Me Shorts, New Zealand's biggest little film festival? As a lockdown treat, they're heading online. For a limited time, they're bringing you the whole 2021 program of more than 70 local and international short films on demand, so you can get stuck in without leaving the house. Show Me Shorts starts tomorrow. Go to showmeshorts.co.nz.
New Leaf Kombucha is New Zealand's only pure kombucha taproom.
Everything you need from your kombucha. Five different varieties on tap, even more in bottles, all brewed organically with no flavourings, colourings or preservatives.
Try their new Hop Butcher, New Leaf's trademark non-alcoholic beer brewed with kiwi hops. Everything you love about beer, without the beer.
New Leaf Kombucha, New Zealand's only pure kombucha taproom. Visit today at 37 Crummer Road, Grey Lynn. Door sales only during level 3. Also, they've got a talking parrot. Come on!
Alright, spot time, I reckon.
Yo, keen. Got any utensils? We'll sacrifice some, eh? We're gonna need a vessel too. I'll scale the last of the spark from Duet.
Wait.
Yeah, spot's on!
Whoa, nah, I mean the beer spot, you know? Amazing, independent, NZ beer.
Ah, the legal buzz, okay. Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, I knew you meant that. It's just, yeah.
95 BFM Drive with Johnny and Big Hungry. A fully legal 3-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jives and jams. 4 to 7pm every weekday on 95 BFM. Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
What's his title? Guy in charge, Dr. Ashley Broom.
The Director General of Health.
Yeah.
The Wire.
Welcome back. Students at years 11 to 13 who live in Alert Level 3 areas will be able to return to classrooms next Tuesday after the Labor Day weekend. Education and COVID-19 Response Minister Chris Hipkins said yesterday that all students will need to wear a mask and keep record of their whereabouts, while staff need to produce a negative test before they return. NCEA and New Zealand scholarship exams would also continue nationwide this year, but students who cannot attend the exams would receive an unexpected event grade. But the Post Primary Teachers Association said it is dismayed and angry at the decision. I spoke to its Tamaki Makaurau Regional Chair, Michael Cabral-Terry.
We think that's a little too soon. As PBTA have previously made clear, we would prefer that we waited until levels of vaccination in the community reached at least 80%. And double vaxxed, that is, reach 80%. And Auckland is not likely to be reaching 80% double vaxxed by Tuesday next week. In fact, at rates of current vaccination, we're looking at sometime in early November, probably. And we think there's no particular reason why the minister couldn't have delayed a return to schooling until the first week of November. That would give us a chance to get those vaccination rates up to it.
Why do you think it should be pushed a little bit later? Do you think there's not enough vaccination rates among years 11 to 13 are not enough?
Yeah, we would say that the best way of containing the spread of COVID and of ensuring the safety of people generally is getting those vaccination rates up. Young people, people aged 12 to 18, have only recently been able to get their vaccinations. They've only recently become eligible. And there's a good chance that a large chunk of students will not be vaccinated, or if they will only have one jab. By delaying returning to school until, say, the second, the first week of November, the 2nd of November, it will mean that our young people will be able to get their vaccination levels up and be that much safer when they return to school.
Okay, but what does that mean for teachers? As more students will be going back to school?
The more people are vaccinated, the safer it is for teachers and students. I mean, we do know that next week we're likely to see some rates of absenteeism. There will be some students who are unsure about returning, who feel unsafe returning, or whose parents are going to keep them at home. But we also know that the more people are vaccinated, the safer the space is, the safer the community becomes. And the longer we can delay returning to school, the higher those vaccination rates are going to be, and therefore the safer classrooms will be for teachers and children.
Could that impact the workload for teachers?
Potentially it might. Returning to school next week may mean that teachers will be delivering some lessons twice, once to the students in front of them in the classroom and once remotely to those students who are staying at home for whatever reason. And there's also the added complication that in secondary schools, it's only going to be years 11, 12 and 13 who are back. Years 9 and 10 will be staying at home. So teachers are going to be having to deliver remote lessons for their juniors whilst being on site. It's unnecessarily complicated.
You mentioned about absent rates could pop up. When school restarts next week, do you think that will impact senior students preparing for the NCEA?
The current situation is going to impact students in preparing for their NCEA. There's no question about that. What is the best for our students is if they are in class, in front of their teacher, preparing and learning. But we would also say that can only happen safely if those vaccination levels are higher. And delaying returning to school by even a week would improve those vaccination rates immeasurably.
The NCEA exams will still go ahead, as Minister Chris Hipkins said yesterday. And now there is an unexpected event grades being introduced. Do you think it will... What effect it will bring to the entire system, considering, especially when it comes to students getting university entrance?
Unexpected event grades, like the minister has suggested, are designed for situations where a student couldn't sit the exam for various reasons, like there's been a death in the family or an illness or something like that. And what teachers would then do is we generate a grade for that student based on their performance in class. The issue for Auckland schools is that a large number of students haven't been able to perform as well in class because learning remotely from home isn't the same, and they've had issues with devices, they've had issues with access, they've had issues with taking part in online learning. And so for a good number of Auckland students, we may be having to go right back to the work they've done in Term 1 or Term 2 to generate a derived grade for them in their external exams. It probably won't have too great an impact on university entrance or the ability of students to get NCEA, but it is going to make things quite tricky. It's going to make things quite complex. It will increase the workload of teachers, and it will also needlessly, I think, increase the anxiety of some students.
I didn't grow up in New Zealand, so I didn't go through the NCEA system, so pardon me if this questions sound off, but could this mean it's a little bit more unfair for students who take subjects that NCEA credits make up, that exams make up a larger part of NCEA credits?
There is that potential of unfairness in the exam results, particularly for those grades where, as you say, the exam is important or is a larger part of the grade. And there's also the unfairness between students in Auckland and those outside of Auckland as well.
And that was Michael Cabro-Terry of the Post Primary Teachers Association talking to me what the Secondary Teachers Union think about the decision to reopen schools despite under alert level 3. Meanwhile, Dr. Jim Russell is a developmental paediatrician, and she told me reopening schools for young people is good for their mental health, but schools need good ventilation to stop any potential COVID-19 spread.
I think it's a balanced decision, and I think it's a complex decision. Overall, I think the government is showing that they're trying to take quite a cautious approach, and staggering the re-entry to school and prioritising the return of older students is recommended in overseas guidance. The reason for this is because students in year 11, 12 and 13 are able to be vaccinated, and in Auckland our vaccination levels are increasing. When they are at school, children who are, who are in year 11, 12 and 13 are probably better able to comply with masking requirements, which are mandatory, to be able to physically distance while on school grounds. And so overseas, what we can see is that we are getting close to being able to follow a gold standard plan for reopening schools. And we'll be able to reduce or mitigate the level of COVID-19 transmission in schools, but we may not be able to reduce it to zero. And so obviously it's a concern for parents in the community. I can appreciate that a lot of parents will feel anxious about this, but I do think it's important that we prioritise reopening schools for students who need this before we prioritise any other form of loosening restrictions. And I think the other thing I think is important to say is that we should expect an increase in cases as we reopen schools. And this is primarily, I think, because when you open up a school, you're opening up a whole part of the community that has been asleep, you know, if I can use that metaphor. And there will be transmission of COVID-19 that takes place around the school. But within the school, what we should be aiming to do is to reduce the transmission of COVID-19 to very, very low. And this is actually possible. So, for instance, San Francisco is often held up as an exemplar of reopening schools. They reopened all schools earlier this year. And despite having Delta in the community at quite high levels, I think it was something like 90% of adults vaccinated, so not higher than that, they have had no school outbreaks and very, very few cases of COVID-19 transmission within school settings. I'm talking about something less than 20 cases of suspected COVID-19 transmission within schools. So sending a child back to school, we can reduce COVID-19 risk within the school itself, but we do need everyone to be vaccinated and to stick to the rules as best as possible so that reopening schools doesn't drive the overall level of community transmission up.
And but on the schools itself, well, everyone has to wear masks and social distance, but could there be more done to mitigate the risks of COVID spread?
Yeah, absolutely. So with Delta, the Delta variant being highly transmissible, we know that Delta has airborne transmission. This means that microscopic virus-laden particles, which are tiny, can waft through the air. And it means that even if you distance as best as you can, if you're in a classroom and there was an infected person in the classroom, then they could be putting out these little plumes of COVID-19 particles into the air where other people can breathe them in. So masking is important because that means that if someone was infected, they would be much less likely to transmit the virus to someone else. But the key, the crucial upgrade that we need to make now around schools is ventilation. So ventilation, what that means is bringing in as much outdoor air as possible and dispersing or replacing the air within classrooms with fresh air from the outside. And what that does is it dries down the level of COVID-19 transmission, if there is any, within the classroom to very low. So for instance, outdoors, if you're outdoors, the risk of transmitting COVID-19 is much, much lower. And so what the plan is by improving ventilation within school classrooms, opening windows and doors, having as much fresh air coming in as possible, you can actually really lower that risk of COVID-19 transmission if a student who was infected happened to be at school.
Jessica, you also mentioned that schools is important for younger people's mental health.
Yes, this is right. So prolonged school closures are harmful for children, and I like to think of schools as essential services for children because they do so much more than provide formal education. They are also pillars of support for young people in terms of their relationships and their friendships, their sense of belonging and connection. And overseas, where there have been prolonged school closures, children have seen, unfortunately, indirect harms from this and have suffered in terms of their mental health and their quality of life. Another thing that I've heard from educators is that the longer a school is closed, the harder it is to bring pupils who are 15, 16, 17 back into school, the harder it is to actually re-engage them and get them to connect. And after school closures, even briefer school closures in Auckland in the past, some communities did see, higher levels of absenteeism for a couple of weeks before students started to return fully on site. So I think that we should be prioritising school reopening, but I think that we need to do it as safely as possible and as responsibly as possible.
That's an interesting point. Could this also be seen for much younger school children, like those in primary school or ECE, because missing out school could impact how many social skills they could pick up?
Yep. I think that all children being able to attend school is important for all children. There may be some benefits, though, in a delay for primary school students. One is that our vaccine levels are still increasing, and with the teacher vaccine mandates having just been announced, a week ago, by a delay in reopening primary schools, it means that we will have time to have a highly vaccinated teacher workforce, even if we delayed a short period of time. So that's one consideration. Transmission of COVID-19 within school settings tends to be first adult to adult, so staff members transmitting to each other, then adult to children, and then child to child. In fact, the child to child transmission is thought to be quite low. It can be very low within schools, and particularly with primary schools, if we reopen and kids are outside, then the risk of transmission is a lot lower. But yes, I think that by reopening schools, we also have an opportunity to reach families who have not been reached by the vaccine rollout and to provide them with good information and even direct them to where they can be vaccinated or possibly have vaccination available on site if that is helpful and in a way that's not stigmatising. So we actually open up more possibilities to reach families who haven't been reached by the vaccine rollout. And that's why I talk about schools being essential services. They actually perform a social function in the community that health alone can't carry.
And that was Dr. Jim Russell talking to me this morning about what she thinks of schools in Alert Level 3 areas reopening. Let me know what you think. If you are a parent who have years 11 to 13 kids, would you send them back to school next week? Or if you are parents of younger children, let's say primary or up to year 10, do you think schools should be reopened for them, or would you rather keep them away for a little bit longer? Or just be honest, you are sick of them hanging around in the house for any time longer. And yeah, let me know if you're a student at high school as well. The text number is 5395, or if you want to talk to me, the number is 309-3879. Okay, moving on. News Hub is proposing to slash the radio reporter role after ending an arrangement with other companies, MediaWorks. Currently, News Hub's parent company, Discovery, is supplying MediaWorks radio stations, including Magic Talk with Radio News, but this arrangement will end in December. MediaWorks stations will also not be simulcasting News Hub's breakfast show, the AM show, as well. Instead, MediaWorks will be creating its own radio newsroom to produce news and a new breakfast show. I spoke to AUT's head of journalism, Greg Treadwell, this morning about the move, and I started by asking what he thought of the news.
Well, the news, first of all, was bad, wasn't it? That another 10 journalists from the New Zealand news landscape, if you like, would be lost. And it's been a long and difficult time for journalism. There's been increasing numbers of job cuts all around the world in all sorts of different contexts. And New Zealand hasn't escaped that either. So at first it seemed just like another cut in the process of death by a thousand cuts. But what I understand is that MediaWorks will in fact now launch its own newsroom. It was the initiator of this. It had a contract with Discovery to provide news for news for that news hub would provide radio news for MediaWorks. And let's not forget that MediaWorks owns something like half the radio stations in the country. It was MediaWorks decided to bring its own reporting back in-house, if you like, and create its own newsroom. And so this is a positive thing, really. Perhaps it's better for MediaWorks to concentrate on its own news journalism rather than buying stories as it did. This goes back from News Hub as it did. And this, of course, goes back to the whole purchase of News Hub and TV3 by its new owners, Discovery. So MediaWorks wasn't part of that sale, but it agreed to buy news from News Hub. But now it wants to do its own news. And so they're talking about, you know, between 15 and 20 staff. So it's possible even that we're going to end up with more reporters than we did. So perhaps this is, at first glance, a bad thing. And at second glance, actually, possibly it has a strong silver lining. So that's kind of the situation as I understand it.
What do you think that means for news, like the diversity of news, considering now the market is when it comes to the radio news market, it's RNZ now and NZME and now potentially MediaWorks?
Well, MediaWorks, of course, might actually be now a more complete and whole opposition, if you like, in the private market competing against NZME. So perhaps NZME will have a more complete opposition in MediaWorks now. It's always been, hasn't it, for a long time, since the loss of family-owned news enterprises and the financialization and shareholder ownership of media organizations. It's been a private industry that has made financial decisions that affect newsrooms and affect the public sphere. And so it's always the tension between private ownership of media organizations and the public role of journalism. I think private media market's important to have. We've ended up with a largely financialized ownership of media organizations, and that's meant that shareholders come first and news product comes second, often, not always. So I guess perhaps I'm a bit more realistic about that than I was in the past. Now I'd like to see the strengthening of our public journalism sector, because so much of the decisions in the private media sector are made on these commercial bases, and we need a stronger and better funded public journalism, I think, publicly funded journalism, and then we have a pretty rich media market.
Well, do you think that making radio reporters redundant could be a little bit, will be more beneficial to News Hub's current TV news operations in the future?
Well, yes, I don't think that necessarily Discovery particularly wanted to provide radio news, and so they now will have just a sort of more complete focus themselves on their television arm, which of course is a very strong brand in New Zealand. MediaWorks is talking about the situation as a real opportunity to establish its own newsroom. In the end, perhaps these organizations are going back to what they do best. And I think, that's probably a good thing in the long run.
And that was AUT's head of journalism, Greg Treadwell, talking to me earlier today about Discovery New Zealand's decision to make News Hub Radio reporters' roles redundant. We just have a couple of texts coming in about schools reopening under Level 3. One said, our year 13 teen is going to school. We're a little nervous, but she's double vexed and we'll drive her to and from so she's not on buses. We're lucky we can work from home and do that. Another one said, I have a year 12 student and this has been a very stressful lockdown for mental health. He is vaccinated and looking forward to getting back to school. His part-time pizza delivery job has been going, so school is definitely more of an essential service. I just hope the teachers will get vaccinated and classes will be held outside as much as possible. Wonder if marquees could be the answer. Keep the texts coming in, and will you also call me on the studio on 309-3879. But for our final story of today, three-storied houses could be more common in Auckland under a new housing policy supported by both Labour and National. The new policy, which was announced earlier this week, enables people to build up to three homes of three stories on most sites without any need for resource consent starting on August 2023. Analysis from consultants PwC told the government these changes would add between 48,200 and 105,000 new dwellings over the next 5 to 8 years. Professor John Tukey is a professor in construction management at AUT, and he said while the new policy is a significant step forward, the devil is in the details.
Possibly is the short version. It depends, because it's going to be dependent on the capacity of the construction industry to deliver, and we've been growing consistently for many years. About 10, 12 years we've been growing at about 16% per annum, and this makes it a very hard thing to deliver on this supernumerary number of houses that are being bandied around by government. So we may see some more, but not necessarily so. The issue is whether or not it's actually going to be allowed to run quite as unfettered as you might consider, because, you know, can you imagine a scenario where there are no controls whatsoever on the houses that people can build in a particular district? And it's hard to imagine that that's going to, there's no right of veto, for example, that'll be creeping in the NIMBY crew.
What do you mean is there could be a one-story house being sandwiched by a lot of three-storied houses
As an example, let's imagine that we had a series of heritage buildings in a particular area. You know, are they going to be built out by a range of three-story tenements of various different types or around them? I can imagine that there will be waivers for things like heritage builds. I can imagine there might be some listed status put to buildings as well. So again, the devil is in the detail. It remains to be seen how this plays out, and we just don't know the answer yet, because at the moment that level of detail has not been really released by government.
And reducing the limit on density is not the silver bullet to growing housing supply.
Absolutely not, because fundamentally, when you come to any housing initiatives, you've got to have money in place, you've got to have capacity in place, and you've got to have land in place. You need all the factors of production in place, otherwise you're not necessarily going to get the outcome that you need.
Okay. Just going back on the construction industry, so currently I presume that construction materials is still in a shortage around the country, right?
Construction materials are in short supply, and we're seeing almost two weekly increases in certain suppliers. So they're basically doing a review every 2 weeks to make sure that any forward orders can be delivered at a particular price. This means that you've got a huge level of variability. Fixed price contracts are extremely hard to come by now, because people are guessing what the materials are going to be costing at the time when they're purchased.
And that was Professor John Tukey at AUT talking to me about the government's new housing policy that removes basically almost all restrictions on housing density. It's 10 to 1 here in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. If you want to let me know your thoughts on any of the stories that we did on the show today, we had more COVID-related issues, reopening schools under alert level 3, the housing policy that removes restrictions on housing density, and MediaWorks laying off almost Discovery laying off all its radio reporters. So do let me know what you think. The text number is 5395, or you can call me on 309-3879. We will still be on for 10 minutes.
Close your eyes, turn up the radio, listen to the music. It's Buddha, the new album from Luke Buddha. The Phoenix Foundation frontman's third solo album has it all. Sparkling songbook melodies, big pompous guitar solos, and collaborations with the likes of Don McGlashan, Ricky Gooch, Mott, and more. Luke Buddha, new album, Buddha. Out now on vinyl and digital wherever fine music is sold.
Kumbaya, join hands and form a circle. The Student Radio Network are coming together on a spiritual vibration, friend.
Tune in to 95BFM Breakfast every Friday morning at 7:40 for a catch-up on what's hip and happening across student radio in Aotearoa. Care of Palmy's Radio Control, Wellie's Radioactive, Christchurch's RDU, and Pride of Dunners, Radio 1.
Brighter than a moonbeam, sweeter than the nectar of a cool mountain stream.
The Breakfast Buffet on 95BFM, brought to you by the Student Radio Network.
That was The Wire.
Koira te hotaka katoa mo tēnei rā, and that's indeed for the Thursday Wire for today, October 21st. Nē te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero kia mātou mo tēnei rā. Thanks to those who spoke to us today. We had Health Minister Andrew Little, the Post-Primary Teachers Association Tamaki Makaurau Regional Chair Michael Cabral-Terry, Developmental Paediatrician Dr. Jim Russell, AUT's Head of Journalism Dr. Greg Treadwell, and Professor John Tukey, a Professor of Construction Management at AUT. E whakarongo ana koe ki te irirangi poho. Don't forget you're still tuned into Radio Bosom or 95BFM. Johnny and Big Hungry will be here at 4 p.m. with the drive show. But for now, Sigrid is remotely taking over the airwaves from me for the 1-2-4. So stay tuned. Ka hoki mai mātou a te rā wiki. I will be back next week. And until then, get your vaccines and stay safe. Mā te wā.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.